Well, now, neighbors, we've got quite a story for you today. We hardly know where to start or where to finish, but I suggest you pull up your chairs because and listen closely, because we've got quite a yarn going for you today, and I don't think you're going to want to miss a bit of it. Now, our guest today on Memory and Music is Jim Vanderbeck. Well, now, Jim, when did you retire from ECO?
In July.
July of last year, and how many years had you spent with the company?
Well, I started in 46.
That gives you in the neighborhood of about 30
about,
years or so,
About
right?
30 years, 29-something.
Okay, well now, to get that start at the start, where are you from? Where were you born?
I was born in a little place called Rileybrook, New Brunswick, which was 56 miles north of Fredericton.
Okay, well, and in what year?
1915.
Well, now that kind of establishes things a little bit for us. Now this name of yours, this Vanderbeck, I find kind of interesting. Is it Dutch or something like
it's
that?
It's a Dutch name, and the closest translation, I spent some time in Holland during the war, and the closest translation from the people over there, it's a direct translation, would be from the brook or stream, probably a canal man or something.
Back meaning brook or canal man,
yeah,
right?
That's what they told me anyway.
Well, now, did not you tell me that you believe your ancestors came to that part of the world about the time that the Acadians were expelled from Quebec? From Nova Scotia?
Yes, they came up from the Hudson River Valley to take over land that the Acadians had been evicted from. I mean, it wasn't my people that evicted them. I mean, it was a land grab or something like that. I don't know what it was, but
well, I think it was due to the war or something. Or
due to the war or something like that.
They moved them down to Louisiana, where they call them Cajuns down there.
Yeah.
Okay, and so your ancestors came up then from the Hudson River Valley.
Yeah, and settled in the Restigouche country.
And what year are we talking about? Around 1700?
1734.
That they, boy, that's going back a while.
Yeah, it went back a long way. There's quite a story of my grandfather. He was the sole survivor, supposedly, I mean, the story had been given to me, of the Great Restigouche Fire.
Uh-huh, I've heard of it now, but it's a long time ago.
They burnt the whole settlement. That settlement that they were living in, and his mother, the last thing she was able to do, she tied two logs together, tied him on it, and shoved him out in the river, and somebody picked him up downstream, and that was the origination of my family.
I'll be darned, and what year was that?
God knows.
That must have been back in the...
My father was an old man when I was born. My father would be over 100. Because he was an old man when I was born. So this would run back a long way.
I'll be darned. Well, I told you, friends, that we had an interesting individual for a guest here. Now, okay, Jim Vanderbeck, we've got you born in Rileybrook in New Brunswick, but what did your father do there?
He was a tourist outfitter.
He'd been there quite a while doing that, eh?
He'd been 40 years in the business, not in there.
No, but
as a young man, he started as a young man on the Tobique, and the rest of he'd been an old guide with the Restigouche Salmon Club. And many famous people, he's telling me about guiding the Prince of Wales and the Kaiser. The Restigouche Salmon Club is the club in the world.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
And he was a guide for them for several years and did on his own. I mean, he ran his business besides.
Okay, well now... But now, your father and mother, your family did not stay in Rileybrook.
It was getting too civilized, so he moved us up into northern Ontario in virgin country. We went first to Cochrane until they built Nakina. They were starting to build Nakina. And then my father established a headquarters, and that camp was started in 1924, and I think it's still
in Nakina.
Yeah.
Now, as you say, when your father set up there, it was just a crossroads or something.
There was nothing there. There was no town. There was no nothing. They were building it. What the purpose of the town was, that when they built the cutoff between the Canadian Northern and the Transcontinental, and this made the new divisional point.
Uh-huh.
So we had a... Well, the whole family, we were raised there in Nakina.
Well, I'll be darned. Now, your mother must have been quite a hardy sort of pioneer type, too, eh?
My mother was a wonderful woman. I mean...
She was a native New Brunswicker, wasn't she?
No, my mother was a native of Newfoundland.
Newfoundland, eh?
Yes, she was, so was her... All her people were from Newfoundland. And,
right. Now, how many brothers and sisters did you wind up with in Nakina?
Well, from New Brunswick to Nakina,
yeah.
I ended up with 10 brothers and sisters, which I am the sole surviving member.
Well, I'll be darned.
So they died at various stages. Some of them died in the flu, and the great flu of the in 1918, and so on. And some of them grew up and they died off from various causes.
Okay, but now let's get back to Nakina, and we've got you growing up there. Now, I think you told me you were born, I think, in 1915 or thereabouts. So you'd start to school in Nakina around in...
I just started in New Brunswick.
You had and, just started?
And then my father moved us to Nakina, and I was educated in Nakina, all in Nakina.
Hello, what was the name of your teacher there?
That's my brother-in-law, Jim Thompson. Yes, he married...
He married an older sister then?
He married my oldest sister.
Well, where's he now? Is he still alive?
No, he was a school teacher there during the Depression. He gradually educated himself, and he became a university teacher. He was a wonderful man. Very wonderful man, yeah.
Well, now... Now, Jim, I'm trying to get all this thing in some kind of order here. You were guiding. You were acting as a tourist guide.
Well, my father had the camp.
Had the camp, yeah.
And this is a different thing. There was no lodge. When a tourist came in, he came in on the train. There was no roads in that country at that time. You came in on the train, and you were given guides, canoes, cooking outfits, supplies, and you took off for the far north, out to James Bay. By the time I was 15, I'd been out to James Bay 3 times. And we did the Ogokee, the Squaw, the Wabamuga, all these wonderful rivers. And the fishing, it was unbelievable. I can tell you one little river, I think, well, I know for a fact today would be fished out. The first time I ever seen, I would say that I was among the first guide to take a Canadian tourist in on this river. It was only 12 miles long, and it was a beautiful little stream. We flew in. That was the early days of the old planes. It was an old H boat, and we flew in there, came down. We landed at 2 o'clock, loaded our gear on the canoe, went down to found the foot of the lake, and by 6 o'clock that evening we had taken 12 trout. Speckled trout out of a pool that weighed over 8 pounds.
Oh, ho, ho, ho. All right, you fishermen. Just listen to that. Now, the thing is, too, Jim, you kept a kind of a diary of what you were doing, and it wound up with a book being written about you called Trap Lines North. Is that correct?
In the many years that I was there, in the winter, I used to trap. You had to have something to do. During the Depression, we had the whole country, town, well, the whole of Canada was on relief. And my father, he didn't believe in taking relief, so he used to pack us all up, take us to the bush. And we had lodges scattered around through the bush, and we'd live in there. Lots of free meat, lots of free fish. And I had my trap ground, my brother had his, my father had his, my sisters had their trap ground. And I thought this was quite the life, so I used to keep a diary. And then as I wrote the diary, I thought it would make a good magazine article, so I started keeping it in a little more detail. And it was in one of our camps when I was guiding a tourist the following one of these summers. It was Mr. Effie Williamson. He was one of our tourists. He saw the books and he said he'd like to take them with him. And he took them down home with him to the States, and he took them to Dodd and Mead Publishing, and they gave them to one of their authors, Stephen W. Meter. And this is where this book came from, this Trapland North. It is it's a true book. I would say 85% is facts.
Well, folks, I have the book. I have seen it, and it's quite a book. And you tell me that it's been read around the world, that you've got letters from Australia, New Zealand, places like that?
Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of letters. The book went into, I would say, the last I saw was 40-some thousand copies. And I was looking the other day, it is in the public library. They located it. Just, they searched and they did find a copy. And was at one time in all schools, in the old sixth grade reader. I don't know if people listening to this, if they can remember a sixth grade reader when the kids was going to school. There was a story about either the sixth or the seventh, there was a story in there. One of the chapters was about a big wolf, a witch wolf. That comes out of the story of Trapland North.
Well, there you have it, neighbors. Traplands North, a story based on the diary kept by our guest today, Mr. Jim Vanderbeck, and a book that had received worldwide attention and has, as Jim was telling you, been in school libraries right across Canada. Well, anyway, Jim, we got to push along here. Now, we've got you doing this guiding work and whatnot and staying in Keene till around about 1939. Yeah, it seems to me you spent a little while working at DeFasco and then you joined the Army. Is that correct?
The tourist business, as a lot of people know, went to pieces during the war, and I had to go south, so I landed up in Hamilton. I worked a little while for DeFasco, and, everybody joined up, and I thought, I'd like to join up too and see a little bit of the
yes.
See a little bit of the world and be paid for it.
That's one way.
I love to do things when I get paid for them.
Yeah, that you and me and lots of people, eh? So what outfit did you join, or what unit?
I joined the Armored Corps, but I was trained in that in Canada, Borden, and I was shipped overseas. And
what year did you go overseas?
1941. And I landed up in an armored unit over there. But they found out that, oh yes, huh? And during, I have to go back, because one of the tourists I had guided had taught.
Yes, I like this. This is an incredible yarn too, folks. Now listen to this one. I mean, Jim he's going to tell us about fitting snorkels on tanks and how he became a welder, that's the story. Now, what's this about you becoming a welder?
Well, I was guiding a man, and he worked for the Lincoln Electric Welding Company, which is the biggest manufacturer of welders in the world. And he said, why don't you come down to Cleveland and go to our school? And I wasn't doing anything one spring between winter trapping and rat trapping, and I went down and I took the course. I came back. Well, anyway, then I went down to Hamilton, and I got a job as a welder. I went in the Army. And I went in the Armored Corps, and they found out I was a welder.
That's
so they pulled me out of there, and they put me in the number one Canadian base workshop. And of all things, which is hard to believe, I welded snorkels on Army tanks.
Okay, all you tank corps types, this is the man who put the snorkels on your tanks.
The snorkel was so that if a landing barge couldn't get close enough to shore, the tank would get air, so that it could go the few feet till they got on land.
Yeah.
And I did that until the whole Army was waterproofed and snorkeled, and then they shipped me over to sometime in, I'm not sure, but anyway, in 44, they shipped me to Belgium, and I did a bit of time in Belgium, Holland, Germany.
Well, now, I like your story about being in the number one Canadian static officer's unit or something, you know.
Oh, yeah, when I went to the continent,
yeah.
they sent me to what they called us, they said it was a number one Canadian base, no, I'm sorry, there were, it was number one Canadian stationary unit, office machinery section.
Yeah.
And they called it a static unit. Well, nobody could, a stationary unit, that was right. It. Nobody could figure out what a stationary unit, and that's exactly what it was. They issued stationary to the whole Allied Army. And we were the office machinery section, and that's what I spent.
Well, your job then was, you'd gone from welding snorkels on
from tanks to typewriters.
Yes,
I went from tanks to typewriters. They used to bring their typewriters, adding machine duplicators in boxes where they'd been hit, and you put them back together for them as best you could. And I was the welder.
You know, I keep thinking on these shows, Jim, that I've heard everything, but I haven't. I mean, this is a brand new one. So here, this part of the war, you're putting typewriters back together, eh, that have been bombed out or something like that. And now at the end of the war, you tell me that you volunteered for the Pacific.
Yeah, I was. We were stationed in Holland, and our officer said, how would you like to get back home in a hurry? So I said, I would, and he said, they're taking volunteers for the Pacific. So I volunteered for the Pacific.
Right.
And I came back, I went to an officer's training center, and it didn't come to anything, and I was demobbed in 45, the fall of 45, and from there I took off for the bush again, but in a different thing. I went up, I was going to diamond drill.
This was around the Timmins area,
The Timmins area.
Now we come to a very important part of this story. You met the young lady up there, right?
Yeah, I went...
What was her name?
Helen Miller.
Uh-huh.
Her father was an old miner, came to Timmins during the Great Fire in Timmins. He's an old shaft captain.
Right.
A lot of people remember what a shaft crew was. He learned his mining in the old Moose River. A lot of you know...
We've heard about the Moose River
disaster. Well, that's where he learned it. And uh-huh. he come up there as an experienced shaft captain. He sank he was the man that led the crew that sank the Silver Miller in Cobalt. And from they sank several shafts around there, and they went to Timmins. Well,
your wife also, at least your wife-to-be, had also... She'd been quite prominent on radio, had she not?
She had done a lot of entertaining. She had been into Valdor and as an entertainer in the 30s.
Right.
And she had a band in there, and she did several years, and till the war came along, and then she went.
She worked, you tell me, as in a munitions factory.
Yeah, she made fuses.
Which was not the safest job in the world.
No, the job they had, several girls lost their hands. It paid well, but if you had a cool head and a good steady hand, you were all right. So,
good for her. Now, don't go too fast now. I mean, as I told you, I talked to your wife on the telephone this afternoon,
mm-hmm.
and we were both... back in radio, back in about those days in different mm-hmm. parts of the world, but it was fun to talk to somebody back from those days. We talked about the old days of the Hattie Gang
mm-hmm.
some of those people. Now, but this was a bit of a whirlwind romance, was it not?
Well, I was in...
Did you meet the young lady on a Wednesday at Mary on a Saturday? I
met her out one Saturday night. Oh, no, one Wednesday night. And on Saturday, I married her. A lot of people say, how come, how did you know? I said, you should know. I said, I just knew, I felt
this
it.
This was right.
Yeah, and it's been many, many happy years.
Great, delighted to hear that.
she had a five-year-old son, and I loved him. And
yes.
He was beautiful.
She was a war widow.
Yeah. Right? Mm-hmm.
Well, there you have it, friends, as we have sometimes said before, the lightning can strike there, something like that, eh?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'll be darned. So here we have you then. Met on Wednesday, married on Saturday to a young lady, who a widow, whose husband was killed overseas. So, where'd you go then? I mean, what were you doing, or how did you set up housekeeping, or what happened here?
Well, we were on the diamond drills, and we traveled around the country a bit, but it wasn't steady enough. So, they were living in a small place in Rouen, and I decided I would go to the west coast and see if I couldn't start another tourist camp. My father had intended to go there, so I decided I'd go out and see what it was all about. And I still remember the guy I was hitchhiking with.
Now tell me this, now listen to this, friends, what a story. Go ahead, tell me this.
That was the wildest ride a man could ever have.
Uh-huh.
This man had one arm cut off at the shoulder and driving a stick shift car. And between steering and shifting,
yes.
Well, we got as far as North Bay, and he said, Jimmy, I got to go to Sudbury. And he said, I can do my business, and if you want to stay with me, he said, I'm going to the West Coast, and we'll work our way out. But he said, come on down to Sudbury. And so I went down with him, and I got with a bunch of the boys, and had a few beer. And
right.
Everybody was looking for a job then. We were just out of the Army. And so some of them said, well, why don't we try Inco in the morning? I didn't even know what Inco was. I knew it was a mining company, but anyway, yeah. I went over with him and with the boys, and I got on. Connaissance Meller.
Great.
Changing roof over the furnaces.
That would be kind of a rough.
So I didn't stay too long.
Uh-huh.
I didn't stay too long. I asked for a transfer. They gave me a transfer. They said the only thing you can have is underground. So I went to Garson. So we rented in a little shack. Housing was bad, very bad in Garson at the time. So we decided we'd build a house. I was making $23 a week at that time. You weren't going to build a very good house.
Not too good.
So somebody told me about the old O'Donohue farm, and there was lots for sale. I went down and I seen this old gentleman. And he took me up to see his lots. Well, you know what the price of property is today. This man said, there's a beautiful lot, nice little knoll, nice and dry, and he said, I'll tell you what, I'll give you that lot for $50. Which is unbelievable, but he had inherited the land, and he wanted to get rid of it. He wanted to go back west. He was just about giving it away, and I told him, I only got $10 put down, and he said, I'll tell you what, Jimmy, these lots are going to go up in value by two. So I said, okay.
Well, you must have been born under a lucky star or something here.
So he gave me two lots with $5 down, 2 months, what was it, two months and a half later, Inco, or the city, or the town, decided to put water there. The lot shot up from up to $250, and by spring there were $1,600.
So you're a wealthy man by this time, then, by those standards.
Well, I mean, when you come out of the Army, you haven't got anything.
That's
everybody
right.
Talked about what the soldiers got when they come out. They didn't get anything. A few bucks to buy a bed with, that's about all. Well, anyway, we didn't have any money to build a house. And somebody told me down on the old Coniston Road, there was a man there had contracted to cut telegraph poles, and he had a bunch of culls. And that's a bum telegraph pole. They have holes in them and they're too crooked or something like that.
Right.
So I went down and made a deal with him for these great huge poles. He wanted all of $2 a piece. So
you were still getting bargains. Go ahead.
So they were so crooked, so I cut them all up in lengths. And coming from the bush, I knew how to use a broad axe. We hewed them all and we made our foundation with them, made our posts with them, and made the walls with them. And I had a big canvas. As soon as we got the walls high enough we could stand up, we put the canvas roof on, we moved in.
Go ahead.
And then for a period of 3 years, we had what's known as a payday house. Each payday, you bought a little more. And at Christmas time, I mean, it took us 3 years to get it complete. At Christmas time, the wife would give me a door, and I'd give her a window.
Great.
So we had.
I love this.
We had many. There was one thing that used to stir things up a bit. There was somebody had a bear chained up, and he used to come at night. And for some reason or other, we had an old wash tub under the house. And for some reason or other, this piece of chain was still hanging to him, and he used to like to get in the wash tub, and he'd go round and round and round. We couldn't figure out what it was. Like come out in here with his bear in there. So
I once was in a summer cottage that had a bear underneath it, so yeah. I know exactly what you're talking about. So how long did you stay in this cabin?
Well, we stayed, it took three or four years. And then we decided we'd go down the Berry Down. Berry Down was just opening up. And this is unbelievable. But in those years, I bought a double lot in the Berry Down for $800. And
now,
I built,
I built a
big home on it. It's still there, and it's a really lovely home. But schools were too far away, and I didn't drive a car. So we decided, the wife and I decided we'd like to get in close. So I can still remember her putting the varnish on the trim when I came in. She was a little angry about that. I sold the house right out from under anyway, and I took this part payment on an old house on Lloyd Street.
Be darned.
And it was right on the corner of Lloyd and Carlton. That's where my second two, next two children was born after 14 years.
Is that house still standing?
That old house is still standing.
I guess you go by and take a look at it.
I think that old thing, I think, was built out of old lumber camps.
Maybe,
you can still see the corks. You know where the corks was in the lumber?
Yeah, yeah.
In the subfloor.
Well, I'll be darned. Okay, so now I'm trying to keep this in some kind of order here. Now, what happened? How long did you live in that house, and then where did you go?
Well, at that time, Inco was rather unsettled. There was a lot of layoffs, and there were a lot of demotions, and we were being shifted from one mine to another. And I had been shifted from Creighton to Garson, Garson to Creighton so many times, and not driving a car kept me, well, I mean, I just couldn't live that way. So I decided I would go to the furthest out place, either either Levac or Lawson Quarry. Well, after I tried the Lawson Quarry Road in those days, I turned back. And I went out to Levac, and yeah, I sold the old house on Lloyd Street, and I just transferred.
Transferred, rather.
Yeah, I bid on a job there, and and the children, they were, well, their young life, they spent a little bit of time around there, but...
Well, now, wait a minute now. They tell me now, Jim, that two points. First of all, you mentioned a George Passy or something like that, who sort of volunteered, unquote, you to be a welder or something.
Well, that was George Passy. Many of the old-timers will remember him. He was quite a brusque man.
Yeah?
Very good boss, and... called me in one day. See, I was working at that time, I was working as a carpenter on the town site. And I liked my job, and he called me in one day and he said, "I hear you say you're a welder." And I said, "I didn't say I was a welder. Somebody told you that." Well, he said, "I'll find out if you are a welder." And George, he takes a piece of steel and he sticks it up under the table and he said, "Well, that." So I put a bead on it, and I hadn't welded for, quite a long time. And George, he's, "That's all I want." He said, "That's fine. I'm putting a job on the board." And he said, "You bid on it." And I was living in a company house at the time, and I decided I would bid on the job.
yes, and, yes, I can believe this. Well, now Jim, we got to push along here, but now
we can jump.
We got you in Levac, and you're working there, but you sort of had a hankering. You thought you'd be happier with your kids growing up in a more rural thing or in a camp type thing. Did you not buy a place on Manitoulin Island?
We bought a summer camp first.
Yeah?
And the children loved it there. They hated to come home, and I was driving back and forth. And I mean, this business is trying to get them up in time to get back for school on Monday. And after doing it for one summer, and the kids said, "Why can't we live here?"
Ah.
So, okay. It was an old hunt camp right on Manitou Lake on Green Bay. And it was a beautiful spot. So I decided that they wanted to live there, and they lived in the old place, and we gradually built it up into a huge electrically heated home, and it was really big. And they had a wonderful wonderful years there. They went to they started high school to the new West Bay High School and got all their education there. And I never need worry about their spending money. They started themselves a truck garden, sold vegetables to the...
Well, Jim, I know. I mean, it was great for the kids, and they've turned out extremely well. As I now, your daughter is working in medical records. Is that right?
She works in medical records in Memorial Hospital.
And a son who was a bachelor of science, is he not doing some research or something?
He's doing some. He's working in the lab in Ottawa for the summer on a research team on something have to do with blood. I couldn't tell you. Quite an important thing anyway, and he loves it. He's trying to make up his mind whether he's going to be a doctor or research.
Eh?
Yeah.
Great. And another son is in where, in Victoria?
He's in Victoria. He's an engineer, and he does something for Molson's.
Okay. Now...
Or Labatt's, I don't know.
Labatt, one or the other. Well, we'll mention them both.
Yeah. Well, we'll give them both a plug.
Both a plug. All right. Now... But you sold the lodge in Annatoona. It's pretty lonesome for your wife.
It was too, after the children went away to school, there was no way she could live there, and we were isolated, and the plow didn't come right down to the house. So I sold it to Dr. Oliver in Sudbury, and he has a very nice summer residence out of it. It's not a summer camp. It's quite a place.
You're around there.
Yes,
right?
It's electrically heated. It's lovely.
Now, we have to push along now here, Jim. Now, after selling this Manitoulin thing, you told me you tried trailer living for a while and didn't like that too well.
Oh, that's terrible.
And then you became a superintendent or something in an apartment?
I was still working for Inco, and we just thought this idea of working as a superintendent, and we worked two blocks, the Summit and the Park View. And after the Park View, we decided that it... the pay is very small, and so we
knocked that off.
We just knocked that off, and we went to work. We went to live in a nice little block in on Paris Street.
Fine,
we got the biggest summer camp in the whole Sudbury area, because Nipawin Lake is right across the road. So you can put your bathing suit on and go over and jump in the lake.
Well, now, Jim, you have a theory, and I think a good one, that we're speaking to pensioners now, or people about to be pensioned. You don't think it's a good idea, to just stop working, eh?
Well, the thing is, anybody going on pension, he should think very, very carefully what he's going to do. His idea isn't going to work out, because he's going to figure this wonderful life, this business. You don't have to get up in the morning. You don't have to do this. You don't have to do that. What you do after a while, you quit doing anything.
Yeah. I saw an article in the paper by a fella who won $1 million in this, one of the Olympic draws or something, and I think the headline on it, this guy said, fine, he'd got the money, but he said, leisure or his death or something like that. He said, keep working.
Keep working. So you must do something like last winter. Now I was pensioned.
But now, wait a minute, I want to get this point in. You got back working in effect for Inco Agriculture Department, isn't that right?
Yeah, somebody told me about it, so I put in an application, and I was accepted. I mean, gardening has always been my hobby.
Right.
I don't hunt, I don't fish, I don't golf, so I thought if I'm going to do something interesting, take my hobby, and when you get paid for it as well.
That's living.
Yes, that's living, and it's a wonderful gang, and it's a good department for an older man. We have a lot of students, and our gang alone, we run higher than 65 average age in the gang. Now, I don't think of any company that I've ever heard of that does this. Inco hires pensioners. They allow them to go on this gang. And these old men, I wouldn't have believed it, that men of that age could turn out that much work.
Well, I'll be darned.
Another thing, I have to give something to the students, too. It's unbelievable the amount of work these girls and boys can turn out, especially the girls. The girls, they do a wonderful job.
Jim, we could talk here for another hour, but we can't do it. Time won't allow us, and I want to say to our listeners that this incredible story, this wonderful story you've heard today, has been told to us by Jim Vanderbeck, who retired in 1975 last year after 30 years with Inkel. Jim, I want to say that it's been a privilege and a pleasure to have you as a guest on Memories and Music.